Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Alexis de Tocqueville, French politician and diplomat best known for his work, Democracy in America, warned two centuries ago about how a dynamic and self-powered democratic system can decay and become the total opposite of its founding values, with mild despotism and the appearance of choice replacing individual thought and authentic liberty. Still, he said, the greatness of America lies in not being more enlightened than any other nation, but in her ability to repair her faults. Does this still hold true today? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Richard Sakwa, Professor Emeritus of Russian and European Politics at the University of Kent. Professor Sakwa, it's great to see you again. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, first I want to ask you, what was your initial reaction when you woke up on November 6th and learned that America has an old new president?
It was mixed feelings, but the immediate one was about opinion polls, because just 2 days ago, before the election, there had been an opinion poll in Iowa which showed Kamala Harris pulling ahead by 3%. So I was speaking to the media and others and suggesting, well, it's too close to call. And of course, we now know that by an overwhelming 5 million votes in a popular ballot and in the Electoral College, Trump has won overwhelmingly, which means his election is legitimate, cannot be contested, and all that talk of civil war and discord, of course there will be, it would be easy, but nevertheless, he's quite clearly the winner. So that was the first and the second feelings, that it's over and done. Third one is that Trump is an extraordinary phenomenon. In 2016, when he was first elected, if you remember, his election and the whole campaign was bound up with the Russiagate allegations, the charge, the accusation.
Absolutely.
That Russia had interfered, that they'd, you know, not only on the media, but stolen the stuff from the Democratic National Committee, and so on.
There were also sanctions introduced against various Russian individuals because of that, which haven't been pulled back.
It was the start of the slide to where we are today, when Obama expelled 35 Russian diplomats in December 2016. And indeed, the whole attack on Michael Flynn, who was Trump's first national security advisor, which in a sense hobbled the whole first Trump administration, because he'd said, look, it makes sense to get on with Russia. And it does. So as Mayflower speech earlier that year. So finally, just to say that this time, Trump 2 will be different from Trump 1. He's learned a few lessons. How different, we don't know, he's come to see. We'll have to see who his appointments are going to be.
Well, before discussing that, I want to ask another personal question. I wonder if you felt vindicated by the choice of the American people, because what it endorses in part is the ability to go against the censuring politically correct consensus, which you also did over the last couple of years when you continued engaging with Russia and its political science circles, despite all the pressure at home.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right there. That in the sense that first, the fact that the American people stood up, as it were, against the mainstream media, against all of that vast propaganda, what people say, the military-industrial media think tank complex, and they spoke. And
they spoke. There were also some intimidation, I think.
And indeed,
like
intimidation.
By law enforcement and by police,
all
by FBI.
And they still, despite, you know, maybe Trump is a flawed vessel for protest, yet he was the only one on offer. There's Jill Stein as a third candidate. But Kamala Harris, of course, I mean, I give her credit. She had 107 days in which to make a campaign. But she, in those 107 days, you know, quite, you know, I give her due for her courage and her commitment. Mm-hmm. But of course, she made one mistake after another, and so did her team. So, and the fact that, you know, people didn't want to vote about identity politics. They didn't want to vote negatively. And her campaign was all the time how bad Trump would be. They wanted something more positive. Mm-hmm. And Trump, paradoxically enough, offered something different.
Well, I think we can argue whether you know, positive is the right term. I heard a couple of Russian experts say that Trump is as shallow and primitive as his opponents are complicated, or one may say confused, and that there is a large constituency in America that is fatigued and perhaps even afraid of this new notion of progress, especially when it moves into the realm of gender roles and family structure, because those people may be afraid of, you know, the whole notion of humanity being sort of questioned or changed. Do you agree with that, that there was an existential sort of motive in these elections as well?
There certainly is. This was, as everybody said, one of the most consequential elections in the United States for decades, and it was. And I quite understand the concerns, for example, women's reproductive rights and so on, or the question of abortion. Trump, of course, towards the end, he shifted it and said, it's up to the states. And a number of states, by the way, in this election as well, passed measures which protect it. So in a sense, that's reasonably sensible to leave it to the states. Of course, one can complain about the Biden and earlier Obama administrations for not having put into law what was Roe versus Wade, a Supreme Court judgment. Courts should not make the law. They are there to interpret and to apply the law. It's up to the parliament or Congress.
But it's not only about abortion, it's about all those experimentation with genders and transgendering. Transgenderism and family structures as well. And I think there has been some reckoning in the New York Times, in the CNN. I have seen some articles suggesting that, you know, those people, those voters who have these objectionable views, they have to be taken seriously. How do you think the liberal circles, the liberal camp is likely to react to all of that?
Trump's victory is a major defeat for that American style of identity politics. I mean, with the rights themselves are one thing. The way that they've become an ideology in the United States is another. And Trumpianism quite openly and completely rejects it. So, of course, it's huge upset in those who push those rather sectarian issues. Whereas Trump elevated or shifted the terms of the debate to fundamental questions of working standards. And so on. One can't say he's a friend to the working class, but he did raise questions about reindustrialization, about America's economy and all the rest. Yeah. So fundamental questions of bread and butter rather than who you are and what you should be.
Well,
so
I think I would argue with you here because I agree that there's certain pragmatic concerns there as well. But I think one of the central lines of division in these elections was the question of freedom and what freedom really is, whether it is all sorts of public and sometimes questionable experimentation with the human form, or whether it's an ability to express your dislike or disapprove of that. I wonder if you agree with that, that the Americans were also choosing between various versions or various definitions of what freedom really means.
Absolutely. It was about terms of the debate and how you should debate these issues, because what, unfortunately, the Democratic establishment and some of it was closing down debate. It wasn't having an open discussion. It was condemning the individuals and using all sorts of censorship. We've seen it, the Twitter files, and on international issues as well. So the sphere of discussion and debate and dialogue had narrowed. Now the fact that Trump was there, he stood up for precisely unorthodox opinions and for an outsider. He's obviously fully an insider, yet he presents himself as an outsider. But by doing so, he opens up exactly, as you say, the public sphere to a wider range of opinions.
I don't know about you, but for me personally, I think my nervous system doesn't always handle well watching the American campaign. Doesn't matter whether it's a Republican or the Democrat, because the very high pitch, I mean, like the intensity of emotions, not just the emotions themselves, they are sometimes too much, but the intensity, everything is at the highest possible volume. I wonder if it's really possible to govern people after you subjected them to that kind of a discourse. I mean, how can you discuss anything at such a high volume?
Absolutely. As I said, the United States has become polarized and that there's been this what's called sorting.
You said it's become polarized. I wonder if they're deliberately driving their people into a mild psychosis, because I mean, when you look at even at Trump's rallies or Kamala Harris's rallies, people do not have calm faces. I mean, they are all on edge.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. The American style of politics is a bit rough, and it's a bit emotional for us Europeans. Yes, no, and the fact that it goes on for so long as well means that they sort of they keep raising the pitch and to get attention from the vast audience.
It looks like chronic PTSD, like post-traumatic stress disorder. Yes. People are always in the fight or flight mode.
Yes.
Do they ever get to the point where they can calm down and use the sort of frontal
cortex? I'd point this to this sort of vision which I've now been putting forwards as an idea, is that the United States and the West as a model of life has presented itself as hypernormal. It's so hypernormal that anything that challenges it, countries outside, and of course voices from within, are considered not only abnormal, but evil and to be condemned. And you're absolutely right. And so the pitch goes higher and higher. But one has to say that this clear, open victory of Trump now actually is, I think, going to put the temperature down. I know there's a lot of talk of the resistance emerging and so on, but yet they can't really do anything because quite clearly the people have spoken. And that actually, as you say, as Alexis de Tocqueville said, is that the Americans, the system itself, has this ability to regenerate itself. And I'm very glad about that. We've been talking a lot at this Valdai meeting and so on, and I've been arguing all the time that what we're talking about is a post-American world, not an anti-American world. What we want Trump to do now is to normalize American politics.
Now, Trump's first presidency was characterized by a lot of internal sabotage, in part due to him not being fully supported by the establishment of the Republican Party. But this time the situation is different. The Republicans have both the control of the executive and the legislative branches. Do you think it provides an opportunity for the Republican Party to do something more substantial?
To do a type of transformation of U.S. foreign and domestic policy.
Do you think they're up to it? Are they interested in that?
This is the 65,000 ruble question, is that who he's going to appoint to his cabinet. And so at the moment, there's enormous amount of speculation about who's going to be there, who's going to be influential. We know one thing so far, is that J.D. Vance, his vice president, is a very important figure. I mean, I'll even put my money on him possibly being a successor.
You're not the only one.
No, indeed. I'm not. So we won't get much if I put a bet on it now. But there's J.D. Vance, but also Donald Trump Jr., who was the one who actually insisted to his father that they appoint J.D. Vance, as opposed to the other ones, plenty of other candidates, Rubio and others, to be the vice president. So, and that is an ideological, that is, as well, a manifesto. We will be different this time, and we will change America.
And he also has the endorsement of a couple very prominent personalities, including Elon Musk, a person who built a lot of pretty extraordinary businesses. And as I was going to this interview, I read about the rumors that he may be appointed as the head of the commission in charge of reforming the U.S. government. Mm. Would you invest your trust in Elon Musk's ability to do that?
I have enormous trust in his ability to do things, whether he can reform the U.S. government in any positive sense, because Musk and another major influential figure in this Trump constellation is Peter Thiel, T-H-I-E-L, the founder of PayPal. Yeah. And these guys are, Thiel even more, these are absolute libertarians. That means anti-government, anti-state, let the market rip. And how they're going to make this work for normal working class Americans, I don't know.
But they put their reputation on the line in order to associate themselves with, as you said, the constellation of Trump. So it looks like they're doing that not out of their own personal or corporate interest, but because they want to advance the interests of their people.
That's right. America has turned, and this election has shown it even more, into a plutocracy. It really is the sort of the oligarchs. I mean, the fact that it's, I mean, we could give a whole list of very, very wealthy Americans who've shaped this election. But I won't just say that Americans were simply, bought. It's just like, I'm not going to be quite so simple. But certainly they're a very powerful force. And so you're absolutely right there. And in this first term, what did he do? Tax cuts for the rich. And what did he do for the normal working people? And it's very hard. We forget the enormous extent of poverty and the difficulties for normal, well, I mean, what would that say, America, the vast middle class to live today, to make ends meet with huge mortgages for extremely high rents, prices going up.
Yeah, the New York subway system, I mean, I think it's a good testament. Well,
just look at the infrastructure, absolutely. So it's they need all of this. But I have a feeling, because, I mean, Musk is quite a phenomenon. The thing is, you know, oligarch, or what, a stoligarch, if he may become something like this. But he has enormous ability, and so does Peter Thiel. These people have achieved something. I'm not defending them as oligarchs, I'm defending them as entrepreneurs with a lot of interesting ideas, and it would be fascinating, Kurt, because America is entering into a major experiment.
Absolutely, and all of us are, you know, stocking up on popcorn to watch it.
Absolutely.
Now,
President Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola is officially banned in Russia, so I have access to it. But for the time being, we have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Since the launch of the special military operation, more than 13,000 foreign mercenaries have joined the Ukrainian military.
Нужно понимать, мы воюем с НАТО. То есть они поверили в то, что Украина победит. Они хотели разделить эту победу. И вот они там решили, как бы, вот сейчас мы приедем, будем русских мочить.
My friend, ты откуда?
Испания.
Испания?
Да.
Барселона?
Барселона.
Yeah, Spanish guy.
You come in this house and try to get a flank on it. Hey, Caproni!
Вот это Эдвин, это Эндрю. Вот здесь сзади на дальнем фоне стоит Крейг. Это британские инструктора, которые занимались с нами в Великобритании.
Там все и французы, и англичане, и американцы, норвежцы, немцы, также поляков много. У всех стран Запада в первую очередь главный интерес ослабить Россию. Пока они стараются делать это за счет украинцев в первую очередь. Военнослужащие, неважно каких стран, которые находятся на территории Украины, это наша законная цель.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Richard Sakwa, Professor Emeritus of Russian and European Politics at the University of Kent. Professor Sakwa, let's talk now about the implications of foreign policy or in the foreign policy realm. Even though it's still pretty early days, we're already hearing a lot of statements or seeing some movements coming from different countries. I want to start with Israel, where a lot of politicians all of a sudden are now talking about the annexation of the entire West Bank now that Trump is in office. How do you think that conflict is likely to evolve?
Well, it's been pretty bad so far. And so Genocide Joe, as many people call him, it's quite unforgivable what the Biden administration did over the last year, allowing mass starvation and mass killing in Gaza, over 700 people killed in the West Bank since October. Some dreadful event. Unquestionably dreadful, and of course extending the war into Lebanon and using these dreadful tactics, attacking hospitals, schools, United Nations buildings and so on. Well, you could say, can it get worse? And of course it can get worse. And Trump, in the last time, his big gamble was on the so-called Abraham Accords, to ditch, to dump the Palestinians and then to have an agreement with Saudi Arabia, normalization with Israel, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and so on. So that didn't work. It provoked this uprising, and the Arab world will not accept that this time. So Trump may want something or other, and, you know, obviously the extremists in the Israeli government have these huge ambitions, from the river to the sea to make it a single state. But of course, they can't do this in isolation because we've got a vast, Arab world and partners like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and United States. So it's going to be very important to see how he can bring them on board, and they quite clearly will not abandon the Palestinian cause today. So it's everything to play for. We just hope that, you know, the Trumpian unpredictability may work to an advantage here, is that he may actually then speak to Netanyahu and say, stop this mass murder and stop some all of this.
Well, I think he is as unpredictable as he is pragmatic. And as you pointed out, his friendship with the Saudis is not only platonic. I mean, they invest a lot in the United States.
Yeah, so that's right.
There's material interest there as well.
Absolutely. And as you say, Trump is mercantilist. I said earlier that we're talking, hoping that he'll normalize things internally, but also to normalize America in foreign policy. A pragmatic oil and relationships and so on is bigger than Israel. So in the larger context, he understands that. And he understands how important with the United Arab Emirates and so many other states as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, turning to the conflict in Ukraine now, according to polls, the majority of Americans are roughly 70%. So it includes also some Democratic voters as well. They want the leadership of the United States to push Ukraine towards a negotiated peace with Russia. What are your bets on how the new administration is going to handle it?
But the thing with Trump, as I said, the important thing is that you must take his words seriously, but not literally. Mm-hmm. And so the 24 hours, just a symbolic way of saying, look, I'm going to deal with this. And he's absolutely right that to allow a war in the heart of Europe with so much suffering and damage and so on, it's damage not obviously to Ukraine, to Russia, to Europe as well, and to global peace and development. If it had been Biden or Kamala Harris who'd won, we'd have continuity. We're going to have a new team. And so they will try to, we don't know, a pause or ceasefire. But what we're always arguing for, we have to start, all negotiations start with the first step. At the moment, there's no steps. So once, if we can actually just start a process. And of course, I think it's important. I mean, he was attacked last time for his good relationship between Trump and Putin. I actually think it's an advantage. Uh-huh. I think that the two can talk, but not the language of ultimatums. Because, uh-huh. There's that famous report, allegedly, that Trump said, if Russia doesn't accept it, they're going to bomb Moscow. I mean, this was just crazy.
Well, as Putin's press secretary said the other day, when the last time they observed that when Trump moved into the White House, his rhetoric substantially shifted, putting it diplomatically. But let me use this opportunity to ask you about the Kremlin, because the Russian leader has so far been quite reserved in his reaction to the results of the American election. But clearly, Vladimir Putin is interested in ending this war, hopefully on Russia's terms. Do you think he will find this opportunity in Trump coming to the White House attractive enough to perhaps compromise, or at least to invest a little bit of trust in the West again?
I think that his position and Russia's official position is to go back to the Istanbul Agreement of March, April 2022.
Adding new territories that Russia had already incorporated.
And taking into account changes on the field itself. Absolutely. This means neutrality, no NATO membership, and acceptance of the territorial position. Because obviously Ukraine is a major country, a big country. Somebody has to govern it. So and I also think that the Kremlin position is that this resolution can't just be local for the time being, to allow the war to start.
Not a ceasefire, a permanent settlement.
Not a Korean-type socialite, a permanent settlement. That means three levels within Ukraine itself, and then the European security level, which is absolutely shattered. And then the global level, US and larger, with China, of course, and India and the Brazil framework. So, it's nested like a Russian doll, all of these. And I will say that Trump has got, he engaged with China earlier quite significantly. So, India, so it's, I have a feeling that let us put it this way, there's a slightly more chance of movement towards some sort of peace settlement now than there would have been if the alternative had happened.
Now, you wrote before that the whole point of NATO was to prevent war, and yet somehow it ended up in the very situation it was designed to avoid. Is there anything that the new American leadership can do to sort of bring NATO back to its initial defense and conflict prevention rather than mission creep orientation.
One of the interesting things, in fact, the most interesting thing about the whole Trump phenomenon is that it's post-Atlanticist. By that I mean that we've lived in Europe since 1945 with the United States deeply involved and since 1949 with NATO and so on. And it's perhaps very good. The United States provided the Marshall Plan and the recovery and so on. And we want to remain allies with the United States. No one is questioning that. But what we don't want is this constant, if you like, vassalization, as some people call it. And what I would like to see is this this post-American Europe emerging, which would be, you know, again, some sort of vision from Lisbon to Vladivostok, an inclusive security body. And of course, this is going to really shock Brussels, the European Union, and those who've really invested into NATO. And what is NATO ultimately? It was an instrument designed for collective defense. It failed after the end of the First Cold War, after 1989, to become a collective security body. And that's a very different thing. Collective defense is against someone. Collective security brings everyone in. And poor Russia was left out. There was no place for Russia in that collective defense system, and we are where we are. So we really have to go to basics. And Trump understands these things. I mean, he's a very smart man. I mean, very strange in his behaviors, but...
And in his way of expressing what he understands, but...
Yes, but, you know, he's actually smart. And what was just a tiny point, in this election, it was very interesting that he was sometimes, this is what made him popular, so charismatic, is that he sometimes is self-reflective. And, you know, even, you know, he gave one of these speeches, and he says, who wrote this nonsense for me? You know, addressing, unless he makes the crowd part of
his
team.
Well, as narcissistic as he appears, yeah, he also appears human.
And yes, like, exactly.
With all his faults and even some awareness of his faults as
He does human quite well.
Since you mentioned Europe, in the last couple of hours, we also learned that the ruling coalition in Germany fell apart, with Chancellor Scholz firing his finance minister, accusing him of diktat, egotism, and betraying the interests of the nation, while the minister accused the chancellor of being unable to offer a viable economic program for Germany at the time of crisis. Where do you think Trump's re-election may nudge Europe and more precisely Germany, because this used to be the sort of the main founding stone of security in Europe.
And indeed the economic powerhouse.
Yeah.
And of course, it's been suffering deindustrialization, lack of investment. And already for 20 years, the lack of investment in infrastructure, health, education, so on, highways. So Germany has lost its shine. And it's now coming to crunch time. And so those two accusations you made are both accurate. We've already seen electoral change. The recent elections in Brandenburg, Thuringia and Saxony have shown not just a strong right-wing movement, but also the astonishing strength of this left conservative, Sarah Wagenknecht. And so the electoral politics of Europe is also changing. I have a feeling that Trump will be a game changer, that we're going to see possibly, changes in Germany. Obviously, now there's going to be an election next year, and that will obviously change with a new government. That's clear. And also in France, we've got elections coming up, and perhaps a Marine Le Pen government finally. In Italy, Meloni will perhaps become more like we anticipated Meloni, not on the right-wing perspective, but simply as challenging that Atlanticist, that NATO, that militaristic bloc. So we may see that. So suddenly, all the pieces are in movement again. How they rearrange themselves, well, who can tell? But it's actually going to be, I think, an important time for Europe to look at itself and to say, what sort of Europe do we want?
Well, actually, you're leading me to my, I guess, final question. I mentioned Alexis de Tocqueville in my introduction. And apart from Democracy in America, he also penned a very interesting work, Self-Interest Well Understood. And I think it's a very timely, still a very timely treatise on how to balance individual freedoms with social interest or the values of society as a whole. And I wonder if you think former Protestant societies like Germany or perhaps some others can still come to a different understanding of their own self-interest, something that, you know, serves them, but also, you know, doesn't contradict their neighborly ties, let's say.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the things which, if we're going to talk about the normalization of international politics, that to move back to the principle of sovereign internationalism, you're a sovereign state, you govern in your own interests, but you're also internationalist. You work with others for common issues. But what we've seen in latest years is a sort of a liberal internationalism, which has undermined the ability for states to shape their own destinies. As you say, in traditions, we've seen in Hungary the way this is working out, in Poland in different ways, in Slovakia. And so many countries want to say, look, no, we want to be part of a larger community, but at the same time, we don't want to give up our own individuality. So I think that Trump's election has yet another sign of us moving into a post-liberal society.
Well, Professor Sakwa, I hope you're right, but I guess we will explore that in our next interview a couple of years from now. Thank you very much for being with us today, though.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.